All right. Our first case for the day is United States X. Rel. Silver versus Omnicare, number 16-4418.
Good morning, Your Honors. Shauna Itchery on behalf of the appellant, Mark Silver. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That is granted, and you're welcome to New Jersey.
Thank you. Your Honors, I thought it would be helpful to first start with the reimbursement structure that's relevant to this case. It puts the alleged public disclosures and the relator's specific allegations into context.
Okay.
There's two types of patients.
Can I just ask you about this chart first?
Sure.
Has counsel seen this?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
There are two types of patients in nursing homes. The first type is a Part A patient. The Part A patient comes directly from the hospital, is very, very sick, stays for 90 days. Then there's the Part D or B or Medicaid patients. They're the majority of the people in the nursing home population. They are long-term. They need being helped, taken care of, basically reimbursed from 91 days on. The 1998 Balanced Budget Act changed the way the reimbursement worked for Medicare Part A. Instead of getting a flat rate for services, services from a provider to the nursing home and then billing the government and getting a dollar-for-dollar amount back, the government decided that it would pay a flat rate per patient per day for each of the nursing home's patients.
For the record, you're pointing out that's Part A.
Part A, yes.
Yes.
For Part A. And so this incentivizes the nursing home now is at risk. The nursing home, if the cost exceeded the flat rate reimbursement, the nursing home had to pay those extra costs. So the nursing home was incentivized then to negotiate with the providers to receive the lowest costs possible. Now this was different than the Medicare Part D, the Medicare Part B, and the Medicaid patients. On this side, what would happen is the providers would service the nursing homes, and the providers would include DME providers, clinical laboratories, ambulance, so on and so forth. They would service the nursing home and then bill and get directly reimbursed from the government at a fee-for-service or a dollar-for-dollar basis. Now, this is where the public disclosures come in, Your Honors. What the government realized is that this had a potential for some anti-kickback violations. And what they realized that at some point, if the nursing home, if the provider, in order to get a nursing home as a client to be able to service the larger Part D and Medicaid population, it could potentially offer discounted prices to the nursing home to be able to gain the Medicare Part D.
And so you have these providers competing, the institutional pharmacies, competing because they want the whole business.
Yes.
So the way it works is that if they can get the nursing home to sign on by giving them discounts for the Part A patients, they'll get the whole business and they can charge market rates or whatever for the
Correct.
Prescriptions.
Exactly right, Your Honors. And it wasn't just institutional pharmacies. It was all providers.
But, of course, Silver didn't uncover all of this. This is all public information.
This is all public information. The structure and the public information, the district court pointed to seven documents. One of the documents was a 1999 OIG advisory opinion, very, very general. It talked about the provider being an ambulance provider. And it was the ambulance provider had
And it also dealt with Part B. Does that matter?
And Part B. Yes, it does matter. It was not specific to the pharmaceutical reimbursement institutional pharmacies. It was basically just saying, hey, the discounted pricing offered to providers could potentially serve as an anti-kickback violation if the discount was below a fair market value. That was what the government was getting out in these public available information in these advisory opinions. The next one was from 2000. It said the same thing. It was a footnote with two sentences that talked about this financial arrangement between providers and nursing homes, and if it was discounted below a fair market value, it could potentially be
So that dealt with swapping with A and B, right?
Yes, A and B, as well as the next one, 2008. It was a paragraph in a 26-page report. Definitely just dealt with swapping. It also provided a list of 10 types of providers. Very, very general public information here.
But the idea of swapping is not unique. It was in the public domain that there was, in fact, swapping going on.
It wasn't in the public domain that swapping was going on. It was in the public domain that this is a potential for swapping. Swapping is offering discounted rates, and that swapping could potentially violate the anti-kickback statute.
Well, to advance your argument a little bit, and maybe this isn't where you're going, but the swapping in a lot of these reports dealt with non-pharmaceuticals, right?
Yes. The only one that dealt with pharmaceuticals was this 2004 CMS review of current standards practice for long-term care pharmacies. And this cited three paragraphs. The district court cited three paragraphs. And all it said was that long-term care pharmacies are concerned that offering nursing facilities rates lower than Medicaid's rate for non-Medicaid residents could be viewed as an inducement. It wasn't an allegation of fraud. It was just that the long-term care pharmacies are concerned that these discounted rates might be viewed as an inducement.
May I read to you from the district court determination? The district court held that publicly disclosed Health and Human Services, Office of the Inspector General, 1999, advisory opinion stated that swapping transactions may be taking place between nursing homes and various service providers. Doesn't that establish that it was known in the industry that this was taking place?
In our opinion, the district court took some liberties with the interpretation of those guidances. Mm-hmm. It wasn't known that nursing homes were engaged in swapping with pharmaceutical companies.
The district court got it wrong?
In our opinion, yes, Your Honor. We think that the district court viewed those publicly available information.
Well, but the district court was referring to an advisory opinion of the Inspector General.
The HHS OIJ, the opinion that's saying that swapping transactions may be taking place, yes. He was viewing the ones I just mentioned. It was a 2000 and a 2008 that referenced swapping in terms of providers and Medicare Part B.
Well, part of your claim, I mean, maybe you could be more precise, is not that you discovered that there was swapping going on.
No. Our claim is that, and what the relator provided, is that very specific information that the defendant, PharAmerica, was offering kickbacks, and he detailed the form of the kickback. And this was not public knowledge. The kickback was a per diem rate per patient per day.
Isn't that swapping?
That is swapping, yes, Your Honor. But he also provided very specific information that the contracts, the amounts of the discount. He was a pharmacy owner and a nursing home operator for many years. He dealt with Omnicare, yes, sir. And he also dealt with a variety of other pharmacies.
Okay.
He was also head of a lot of associations and went to regional and national meetings regularly. So he's very involved in the industry.
I'm just trying to get something more precise. What did Silver discover? That the exact pricing that was going on, the exchange that was taking place?
What exactly was unique about what he discovered? Sorry, Your Honor. In that the form of the discount was the per diem rate. He knew the per diem rate. He knew that the per diem rate was below cost. That was not in the public disclosures. He also discovered that the fact that these contracts, they had what was called true-up clauses. And those true-up clauses facially hid the scheme. What the true-up clauses said was that every quarter, PharAmerica would do an accounting. And they would account for the amount that was charged to the nursing home and the per diem amount and compare that to the actual cost of the drugs to service the nursing home. And every 3 months, they would take the difference and they would charge the nursing home the money that it owed back to PharAmerica. But they never enforced those true-up clauses. They were just placed in the contract to facially hide the scheme so that to the close observer, it would look as though they were compliant with the anti-kickback statute, but they actually weren't. And our Mr. Mark Silver, he discovered that. He brought that to the government.
How did he discover it?
Mark Silver, he received contracts. He negotiated contracts with, or PharAmerica had offered him some per diems. He never accepted those. He had relationships with nursing homes, and he talked with administrators.
But not this particular defendant.
Southgate was a nursing home in New Jersey that received a rate of $22 per patient per day from PharAmerica. He also has information from a consultant who represented nursing homes who negotiated contracts with PharAmerica. And those he had the actual contracts where, and this was on the West Coast, those contracts had the per diem rate with the true-up clauses.
What aspect of that can you say was not in the public domain? In other words, why shouldn't the public disclosure bar apply in this case?
Why shouldn't it?
Yes.
Because the allegation and transaction of fraud was not disclosed. It was not a universal, widespread fraud that was disclosed. It was a guidance. The government issued guidance to make sure that the nursing homes were acting in ethically and lawful way. And what the effect of the district court's holding would have, it would immunize an entire industry. What we offered was very, very specific information. It would be akin to the Cooper case in the 11th Circuit, where there was a widespread disclosure of Medicare secondary payer fraud. And what the court held was that that was not an allegation or transaction of fraud. It would go against the purpose of the False Claims Act, which would be to encourage whistleblowers and, you know, protect the government parasitic lawsuits. This lawsuit was not a parasitic lawsuit. The government was not placed on the trail of the fraud. Our relator brought information. He studied documents that the government would have never have seen. And even if they had seen the transactions between PharMerica and nursing homes, they wouldn't have known.
When you say information, do you mean pricing information?
Pricing information, contracts, information regarding knowledge. They were competing with Omnicare, a consultant.
So is it fair to say that you did not discover that the fraud was taking place? You just took public information and made it more precise on the part of...
We would not...
All right. That's a mistake. Go ahead and correct my comment.
We would not say that that was the case. We would say that we uncovered this fraud. The government would not have known that this fraud was occurring. They would not have been able to start an investigation without our information. And we believe that the district court erred when it applied the industry-wide public disclosure bar. There are some courts that have adopted it, but in U.S. et al. Prixel versus Sodexo, which is a non-presidential Third Circuit opinion that adopted the analysis of the lower court, we think they did a great job of synthesizing the cases.
I think it was a great job, too.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree. And what they said there, what the court said there, was that if the fraud occurs on a transactional level and individual perpetrators are difficult to discern, then the industry-wide public disclosure bar doesn't apply, and that is the exact case here.
Well, let me ask you another thing. I mean, you persuasively, I think, argued in your reply brief that, hey, the red brief only discussed reliance by your client,
yes.
and the analysis should be something different. Maybe you could just kind of crystallize for us how the district court got it wrong, perhaps.
Sure. The district court referenced Mr. Silver's testimony in his deposition, and it erred in doing that. And if it relied on that, it was wrong, because the case law is absolutely clear that for a public disclosure analysis, relator's independent knowledge is irrelevant. It only becomes into play when in the original source analysis. In a case, U.S. X. Rel. Mitstick, 1990 case out of the 99 case out of the Third Circuit, this was a case where the relator previously filed a suit in the state court that had the same allegations, and then he subsequently filed a QI-TAM case. The court found that it was publicly disclosed. All of the allegations were already out there. He said, you know what? No, I didn't use those public disclosures. I'm the one that disclosed it. I used my independent knowledge to draft this complaint. And the court said, your independent knowledge is irrelevant. What you relied on is irrelevant for a public disclosure analysis. It's only relevant for an original source analysis.
Well, I'm concerned about your discovery of fraud, and I wonder if you really did discover fraud. If I were to think that you did not, but you, because of Silver's experience, and he did seem to have a lot of experience, he took all the pieces that were out there and put them together, including the numbers, and concluded that there was a fraud. Does that entitle Mr. Silver to recover?
Well, the first step in Moore Fisheries that outlines there's a multiple-step process, and the first step would be discovering finding that there's an allegation or transaction of fraud that has been publicly disclosed. We would argue that that has not happened. The second step would be, if the court does find that it's publicly disclosed, to see if it's substantially similar.
I understand your chart was very helpful.
Oh, good. Thank you, Your Honor. And we would argue that if the court were to find that an allegation or transaction of fraud was publicly disclosed, it's not substantially similar to the complaint. The complaint adds vital details. And in the a couple of circuits. The Third Circuit has not defined substantially similar.
Do we need to do that in this case?
We don't think so. We think it stops at first. We don't believe that the allegation or transaction or fraud was publicly disclosed. So we think it stops there.
Okay, thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Manti, and I represent For America Corporation. This is an unusual but simple case. It's unusual because the relator in this case admitted under oath that he could only rely on the public disclosures in crafting his complaint. And that's because he had no prior relationship with For America. He had no business relationship with them. He did not work with them. And he had no connection with any of the employees.
But didn't he bring something to the table? You know, a lot of your briefs seem, you know, very sort of one-sided, a lot of what you wrote. I mean, as if this was it. He did bring some expertise and some information to the table, didn't he?
Well, I think his expertise is a different issue. That really goes to the original source analysis and is more in the way of background information. What he did bring, and I beg to differ with my colleague's description, he did not bring the costs. He did not know what the costs were. He admitted in his deposition that he had no idea whether the prices in the contracts that he brought to the table were below cost or not, and he had no idea whether they involved swapping. And in fact, we have the so-called colleague, Mr. Lennox, also on the record saying that the prices in those contracts, which he negotiated, were fair market value, and that he, as the intermediary between the pharmacy and the nursing home negotiating the pharmacy contract, never accepted a Part A offer in exchange for any type of Part D or Medicaid business. So the evidence in the record, as opposed to what's been alleged in the complaint, and at this stage they can't rely on the complaint anymore. They have to come forward with affirmative evidence showing that the court has jurisdiction or that the court should not dismiss the case under the post-Pupaca version
of the
statute.
Well, I mean, one of the things you point to in the appendix 688 to 689, there's the 10-K form, right?
Yes.
I mean, he may have relied on this, but I don't see where I know I'm not an accountant, but I don't see where this discloses a fraud or discloses the scheme, you know, generally.
Well, but again, I think to Judge Fuente's observation earlier, what Mr. Silver did was he combed the public record in search of information about PharMerica, and then he packed it together into a complaint. And what we need to do, the exercise in terms of the first stage of the prior public disclosure analysis, is to determine not whether there's fraud in the abstract. It's not an abstract inquiry. It's whether the allegations publicly disclosed are similar to or substantially similar to the allegations in the complaint. And here, because he had no information about PharMerica, about its granular costs by which it could, its costs at a nursing home level, payer by payer, all he could do was rely on the financial statements.
Because there was a sense that there was fraud out there. But
there was a sense that there was.
Mr. Silver, I suppose maybe you could say to his credit, put all those pieces together and came up with the game plan. There was fraud going on, but for him, let's say, the case would not have been filed.
But that, I don't think that's true either, because, first of all, let's back up a step. That really, again, I think goes to the original source argument. Here, you know, at the very beginning, we have to look whether the complaint was based upon allegations and transactions publicly disclosed in certain public disclosures. We have him on record admitting, and that is sufficient in and of itself to move to the second phase. And I can move to the second phase and discuss whether his industry expertise, really what he has is an experience-based opinion, as this court observed in the Schumann case. And that is not sufficient to establish direct and independent knowledge, sufficient to establish yourself as an original source.
What about the post-2010 time period? The information he provides is materially adding to what was in the public disclosures.
Well, and I'm going to come back to your question, Judge Chigaris, about the 10-Ks. The question is whether it materially adds, and it doesn't, because what we have is the additions, the significant additions that Mr. Silver alleges are his allegations as to what Mr. Lennox would testify to. Well, we have Mr. Lennox's testimony, and it directly contradicts the allegations in the complaint. So that did not materially add to anything that was in the public disclosures. You have the contracts themselves. Mr. Silver himself testified that he couldn't tell whether those were swapping contracts because he didn't have sufficient information. He didn't know whether they were below cost. And we have Mr. Lennox saying that the pricing of those contracts were fair market value. So those contracts don't add anything. So what you're left with is this notion of the true-up clauses. Well, the true-up clause, I think, it's not a separate fraud. It's just a timing mechanism. What the relators are alleging is that swapping generally involves selling something below cost or below fair market value to under the Part A provision where the nursing home is financially at risk in exchange for the referral of other business that can be billed at a higher price.
Can you really pass off the true-up clauses so quickly? I mean, it seems to be, according to the allegations, this is a major part of the scheme. Are these true-up clauses?
Well, those are the allegations, but I think if you look at the contract, really it just turns out to be a timing mechanism. The question is the price below fair market value up front, or does it become below fair market value down the road? It's the same kickback, and it's the same mechanism for paying the kickback, which is charging a fee that is allegedly below fair market value. So the timing of the payment of the kickback is not a separate fraud, and it really doesn't bring anything material to the public disclosures. And honestly, the notion that Mr. Silver brought swap or per diem pricing to the attention of the government is really laughable. His allegations in the complaint itself are that per diem pricing was widespread throughout the industry. And certainly, per diem pricing in and of itself does not equate to swapping. And there is no... You can't identify the discount merely from stating what the price is in the contract. So, again, Mr. Silver's testimony is important in this case because, on the one hand, typically relators are arguing that they didn't rely on the public disclosures in crafting their complaint. In this court and every circuit other than the Fourth Circuit has held that such direct reliance is not necessary to trigger the bar. But it is sufficient, and it has to be, because otherwise you run into a very odd situation where a relator who truly may not have known anything about the prior public disclosure is barred, but a relator like Mr. Silver, who admits that he relied only on the public disclosures, is allowed to move forward.
Did he say only? I mean, isn't that a little bit of an overstatement?
That we've quoted this passage in the brief, Your Honor. He said, I could only rely on what was in the public disclosures. And that is true because if you look at the other testimony and even the allegations in the complaint, he has no direct personal knowledge of anything about Pharmerica. He never did business with Pharmerica. He was never employed by Pharmerica. He never had a contract with Pharmerica. He admits in his deposition that he had no knowledge of the inner workings of the company. He had no knowledge of their costs. So what else was there for him to rely on? And I think it's obvious what's going on here, and it goes back to what Judge Fuentes observed, which is that he has some industry expertise. He's not the only one in the world who has industry expertise. He gathered all the information up in the public disclosures. He took a look at the 10-Ks, figured out what Pharmerica's costs were to deliver drugs, and he put it together into a complaint. And if you look at the complaint itself, there's only about 13 paragraphs that say anything about Pharmerica. And those 13 paragraphs are devoted primarily to alleging what Mr. Lennox would testify to. And what Mr. Lennox ultimately did testify to is that the prices that he negotiated and that are reflected in the contracts to which Mr. Silver refers were fair market value. And instead of getting back to your question about the 10-K, Your Honor, if you look at the deposition testimony, Mr. Silver testifies that he was able to find certain data points in the 10-K. And those were things like the cost of goods sold, the selling SG&A, which is selling general administration, their operating income, their net income, the number of beds, all the things that he identifies in his deposition testimony actually are in the 10-K. And you can use this information to make the same exact calculation that Mr. Silver did for his own pharmacy, which is to find the average costs per bed per day. And it's very simple, and you don't have to be Price Waterhouse to do it. I can walk you through it if you want.
That's all right. You wrote about it.
So. It ends up being $15.50 a day per bed per day.
Let me ask you, we're eventually going to have to write something on this. Do we need to break new ground here, or does our jurisprudence cover this?
Your jurisprudence.
Specifically, are we going to have to define substantially similar as the Seventh and Ninth Circuits did?
No. The substantially similar standards have been out there forever, because when the statute said, based upon, this court and others routinely interpreted that to mean substantially similar to or supported by. So the prior case law, I think, handles that completely. Insofar as the import of his deposition testimony, I think this court is well within this court's prior decisions. It's in a recent non-precedential decision, U.S. X. Rel. Morgan versus Express Scripts, this court found that the complaint was based upon the public disclosures because in evidence was an email that the relator had sent forwarding one of the public disclosures. And in that case, the court said they need not resort to algebraic representations to determine that the relator based his complaint on the public disclosures. And so we have an analogous situation here. And certainly with regard to his expertise and the application of his expertise, this is squarely within the U.S. X. Rel. Schuman decision, which in a situation where the relator, Schuman, had worked for one of the alleged conspirators, had reviewed the contracts themselves, had negotiated the contracts themselves, had knowledge of the internal workings of the company, the court still found that he wasn't an original source because he relied largely on his experienced belief, his experience-based belief. And that's what we have here. You have a relator who is a self-proclaimed expert in the industry, who's gathered together a lot of information that all has been previously disclosed. And he, as he testifies, in his expert opinion, he knew or he's assumed that swapping was going on.
You don't deny that swapping was in fact going on, involving Pharmerica and I think there was another one.
Omnicare,
yeah. But your argument is that that was already public and all Mr. Silver did was put together the math and come to the conclusion that there was fraud.
What was public was all the indicia necessary to infer that Pharmerica does not admit that it was engaged in swapping. In fact, we adamantly deny that, and we believe that we would be able to prove that at trial. It's a very complicated, issue. But specifically, the prior public disclosure analysis doesn't require a finding of fraud in the abstract. What it requires is for the court to compare the allegations in the complaint to the publicly disclosed allegations. And again, I think it's obvious what's going on here is that Mr. Silver, a self-proclaimed expert in the industry, and I don't doubt his expertise in the long time that he spent in the industry, but what he did, as the district court found, he's the paradigmatic cryptographer. He put together a lot of things from the public disclosures, which led him to an inference, and that's the only thing that the complaint alleges is an inference of fraud. And in fact, Mr. Silver testified in his deposition, and we cited to it in our briefs, that because he didn't know what our costs were at the nursing home level per customer, or our profits were at the nursing home level by payer, he couldn't say whether any contract involved swapping or not. And that was the information he was hoping to get in discovery. So what he actually brought was nothing more than what was already out there in the public disclosures. True, he was able to package it, but that is the transaction of fraud upon which he based his complaint. The concept of the transaction of fraud, I think, is important too, because we're not out there looking for a bag drop. The concealment here is the pricing, is the cost of the drugs.
Can I ask you another question? Your adversary developed their argument about this industry-wide public disclosure bar in their reply brief. You didn't have a chance to respond to it. Would you like to hear?
I would love to, Your Honor. The court should actually categorically reject any notion that there is a separate industry-wide disclosure bar. There is only disclosure, and the disclosure can happen a number of different ways. It could happen because by naming the specific defendant, or it could occur because there is sufficient information in the public record from which, or the public disclosures from which, the defendant could be directly identified. And this is not an industry-wide public disclosure case, because if you look at all of the public disclosures together, several of them specifically identify Pharmerica. So the reports on the consolidation in the industry.
But isn't the whole industry basically three different groups? I mean, isn't it a de facto public disclosure?
Well, I think in part it is, because the question is Pharmerica directly identifiable from the public disclosures? And in this case, they certainly are. And one of the factors to be considered in whether they are directly identifiable is the consolidation in the industry. They clearly, two companies dominate this industry, Pharmerica and Omnicare. So when you're talking about long-term care pharmacy, you're talking about one or the other of them, okay? So I think that fact, in combination with all of the other public disclosures upon which Mr. Silver admits he relied, including the financial statements, directly identify Pharmerica in this case. And so I don't think it's necessary for the court, in the context of this case, to make a broad determination as to the applicability of a so-called industry-wide public disclosure. Certainly not with respect to this relator. I mean, again, going back to sort of the core principle here, this is a relator who admits that he relied on public disclosures to put it together his complaint. He's the classic parasitic relator who brought nothing new to the government, and he admits that, because the only thing that he had in addition to the public disclosures at the end of the day were two contract prices.
Let me ask you a question. This is a note that I made after reviewing the district court's opinion. The district court said that the information needed to conclude that Pharmerica was engaged in swapping was provided by Pharmerica's own publicly disclosed documents. Is that accurate?
I would say that was a misstatement, or not a misstatement, but if you go further down into the opinion, it says that it was sufficient to draw the inference of swapping, and that's what's necessary to trigger the public disclosure bar. If you go back to Zizek, the transaction of fraud is the true state of facts and the false state of facts sufficient to draw the inference that fraud was occurring. And I think ultimately what Judge Hillman determined, notwithstanding some improvident language in that passage, he found that it was sufficient to draw the inference of fraud, and I believe that it was on page 19 or 21 of the order. This is exactly what Mr. Silver did, is he drew an inference of fraud. He had no actual evidence of fraud, notwithstanding the references to the contracts, because, again, he testified about the contracts. We asked him. And he said, no, he didn't know whether any of those contracts were priced below cost, and the only information in the record is that the prices were fair market value, because that's what his contact, Mr. Lennick, testified. And if you recall, as my colleague explained, Mr. Lennick's job was to negotiate pharmacy services agreements between long-term care pharmacies and nursing homes. And his job was to get them the best price that they could get.
Counsel, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut you off here. The red light's on.
Yes, thank you.
But thank you. And we'll hear a reply. Kill off for just 1 second.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. You can proceed.
All right. Your Honor, I'm going to address the testimony, but we don't even get there, because the allegation of transaction of fraud was not disclosed. It's not substantially the same, and the case law is clear, not only in the Third Circuit, but the Ninth, the Second, the Fifth, the Tenth, the Sixth Circuit, that a relator's independent knowledge, what the relator relied on, is totally irrelevant in a public disclosure analysis. It only comes into play during the original source analysis.
Well, the question is, did he uncover the fraud? Did he uncover the fraud?
Your Honor, yes, he did. We talked a lot about his expertise. He does have a lot of expertise. But he put together non-public information. He put together non-public
May I ask you a question about his deposition testimony?
Sure.
Did he not testify in a deposition that he required no information beyond what was publicly disclosed in financial records to determine that Pharmerica was swapping?
That testimony is grossly mischaracterized. And let me put it into...
I didn't misread it, did I?
There's this section before it is not included. And the section before his deposition, he talks about how he didn't have the gross revenue from Medicaid, he didn't have the gross revenue from Medicare, the net costs of the medication for Medicare, and then have the operational costs below it. And Pharmerica, I believe, has those documents somewhere. Now, that type of statement would fully define what I'm looking for, enable me to make a decision whether the Medicare cost for every individual per diem contract or going up the line for a group of homes was below cost or below market value. But I never got that from Pharmerica. There is nothing publicly that shows me these things. So I can only rely upon what's out there on the basis of public disclosure. That was page A679 to A680. His testimony for someone that was a parasite,
doesn't that then go to the fact that he took the public disclosures and drew an inference of fraud, and that's all he did because he had nothing else to go on?
Your Honor, let me put this in a little bit of a perspective. He was deposed for 2 days. They cited 26 pages of his testimony, only six of which they repeat snippets throughout. They totally mischaracterize it. He's a person that was being questioned by a very, very smart, sophisticated attorney that was trying to get testimony to include in this type of briefing. As we set forth, his testimony isn't even relevant to a public disclosure analysis. It's confusing, but it's not irrelevant. It should only come into play in an original source.
What we have to try to discern here is whether the allegations of the complaint are based upon the public disclosures.
And we would argue that, first off, there was no public disclosure that contained an allegation or transaction or fraud. And second of all, the complaint was not substantially similar. He added significant facts. What was not in the public disclosure were the contracts, the per diem pricing, the costs. Those were all not in the public disclosure. Public available information. Those are things that our client, Mr. Mark Silver, had provided. He's been in the industry. He's been spoken with Pharmerica, spoken with other pharmaceutical companies. He ran a pharmacy. He ran a nursing home, and he obtained specific information, non-public, through those avenues. And the true-up clause is very significant. And what my colleague talked about is just the fact that there's a true-up clause isn't important. The fact is that there is a true-up clause, and it wasn't enforced. That is the key piece of information. Our client knew that true-up clause, it wasn't enforced. To the onlooker, they would look at the contract. If the government were set on the trail of fraud, they would get the contracts, they would look at the contracts, they would see the true-up clause, and they would say, there's no fraud going on here, because they're truing up. Our relator testified, and Mr. Lennick, consultant, whose testimony is also grossly mischaracterized, they testified that those true-up clause were never enforced. And that's a key piece of information that the government didn't know.
Are true-up costs inherent in every swapping scheme?
No.
I mean, isn't that part of the swap?
Well, the true-up clause...
Somewhere along the cost are going to be very, very low, or they're going to be essentially gifts to the nursing homes.
No, the true-up clause basically says we're going to give you the contract says we're going to give you a discounted price up front, but the true-up clause says actually it's not discounted because we're going to charge you back later.
Right.
So that it hides the scheme, so it wouldn't appear that they're swapping on the face of the contract.
Isn't that part of the swapping scheme itself?
No, it's not, and that definitely it's part of what the relator brings to the table. It's not part of the scheme that has been in the public available documents.
I asked your adversary, is this a case where we're going to have to break new legal ground, or is our jurisprudence sufficient to decide this one?
I think the jurisprudence is sufficient. I think it stops at the first. There's no allegation or transaction of fraud. The In terms of the second, the Third Circuit hasn't defined substantially similar, but the Zizek case does a substantially similar analysis. What it just uses, you know, Pharmerica in their brief relied upon the surface level appeal of partly based upon. The Zizek court did do a substantially similar analysis, but they didn't define substantially similar.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We will take this case under advisement, and I want to thank and congratulate counsel on excellent argument and excellent briefing in this case.